Omaha Public Radio presents another program from Film Streams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema on Noon Forum. On today's program, we'll hear a panel discussion which followed a special screening of the 2010 documentary film The Last Survivor, directed by Michael Clayman and Michael Pertnoy. This program, presented in collaboration with the Institute for Holocaust Education, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, May 3, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the panelists and do not necessarily represent those of Film Streams, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. The Last Survivor is a character-based, feature-length documentary film that presents the stories of genocide survivors and their struggle to make sense of tragedy by working to educate, motivate, and foster a civic response to these horrific acts. Following the lives of survivors of four different genocides and mass atrocities, the Holocaust, Rwanda, Darfur, and the Congo, The Last Survivor presents a unique opportunity to learn from the lessons and mistakes of our past in order to have a lasting social impact on how we act collectively in the face of similar issues today, such as the growing liberal hate in the United States toward public religious expression. In choosing four survivors who work as activists in the anti-genocide movement, the film promotes the vital importance of survivor advocacy, the need for genocide survivors to become leaders in a movement that seeks to remind the world what happens when apathy and inaction prevail. By presenting these stories of loss, survival, and hope side by side, the film highlights the commonalities these individuals share, both as survivors and more broadly as human beings. Having been shot on location in five countries across four continents, the film focuses on the universality of the horror of genocide, combating the misguided notion that genocide is something that happens, quote, over there. Rather, the film asks its audience to consider genocide as an evil that has occurred on nearly every continent and one that affects all of us as human beings. In the end, The Last Survivor is, above all else, an intimate meditation on how one begins to pick up the pieces of a broken life after experiencing such tragedy. The members of the panel will include Michael Clayman, the director of the film, B. Karp, a survivor of the Nazi Holocaust, and Beth Selden Dotan, the director of the Institute for Holocaust Education at Omaha's Jewish Community Center. Here now to introduce the program is Casey Logan, Communications Coordinator at Film Streams.
We're really pleased to be partnering with the Institute for Holocaust Education on this screening tonight, and in a moment, Beth will say a few words, and she'll introduce one of our special guests for tonight. This screening is part of our community development program. And through that program, Film Streams partners with nonprofits and community groups on films and discussions that relate to their missions and programming. It's a great way of using film as a catalyst for really important discussions. And thank you so much for being here, and I'll hand it over to Beth.
Thank you. I just have to say that we're really excited to have this partnership with Film Streams, and Maggie and Casey, and Rachel is not well tonight, so she unfortunately couldn't come. So we thank you for all the work that you've put into the program. I'm the director of the Institute for Holocaust Education, and Laura and Hillary, my wonderful staff, are here with me today, too. And it's been an important spring for us. We are concluding the Holocaust commemoration days, and last month was Genocide Prevention Month as well. And we really thought that this film would be appropriate this time of year at the end of a short film series that we ran, two films at the Jewish Community Center, and then this film partnered here. Tonight, we will bear witness to the stories of four individuals who tell their stories through teaching us how they have survived. Righteous Pictures Production Company uses a cross-platform approach to storytelling and finding a way to foster social change within this documentary, The Last Survivor. Filmmakers Michael Pertnoy and Michael Clayman, who is here with us tonight, are also community organizers and social activists, among other things. So their film really tells a story from a number of different aspects. Their experiences give their work a special flavor with a new lens to understand how storytelling can be a powerful educational tool. I know that many of you who are here are educators, and we're thrilled to have you here. You'll see at the end of the film that there will be some websites for all of us to explore and learn more about genocide and education in that area as well. Michael has come in from New York and is going to be with us for the panel that will take place after the film. And just a little round of applause, and he'll say a few words.
Thank you. Well, first of all, I just want to thank Institute for Holocaust Education and Beth and Laura for bringing me here and putting this event together and just being such wonderful hosts to me, showing me a little bit of Omaha. It's my first time in Nebraska, so it's been a fun day. Now, the film, making this film was a very long journey that crossed my lives with some very inspirational and powerful individuals who you'll get a chance to meet tonight. The reason we set out to make the film in the first place was always about showing it around the country and around the world to spark dialogue and hopefully action. So that's sort of the point of tonight's screening, is that we can watch the film and then hopefully speak about the issue of genocide and, more importantly, genocide prevention and how we can all work to end this horrific crime. Thanks.
Well, again, I'm Beth Dotan. I know that you were hoping that Alan Potash would be here. Alan is the regional director of the Anti-Defamation League, the Plains States region. Jessica Gall, who's our education project director, is here. And Alan, unfortunately, couldn't make it with us tonight. We do so many wonderful things together with the Anti-Defamation League, and I hope some of you have been to some of the presentations and programs that they've done. On the panel is B. Karp, who is a local child survivor of the Holocaust, born in Lauterbach, Germany. And in addition to being imprisoned in camps in France, she was saved by a French organization called the OSE and hidden in children's homes and convents, and lost her parents during the war and many, many relatives. We introduced Michael a little while ago. I want to give you just a few details, and then we'll open up for questions. Michael graduated from the University of Pennsylvania in 2006 with a degree in film history, theory, and criticism, and you probably have some more information about that. He was named a Fulbright Scholar to work on Righteous Pictures' second documentary that they're working on now called Web. And his work has taken him to Peru and other sites to explore cross-cultural collaboration of the internet, and hopefully he'll speak a little bit more about that as well. Michael was director on The Righteous Pictures, their first film, The Last Survivor, and has worked on other short films, including I'm Only Sighing and The Waltz. He has worked in numerous educational venues, including the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and College Board. Michael has worked on other award-winning projects as well. So I think we'll open up for a question. We have a couple of mics going around, and we'll take a question right there.
I was kind of skeptical when I saw this movie because I literally think it's almost impossible to create an awareness of this issue. It's so incredibly complex and hard for us here to relate to something like this. But I was at the end, I was quite impressed, and thank you very much for doing that, Michael.
No, thank you.
My question is on the current situation, and as a lot of people may know, the UN has passed what's called the Responsibility to Protect now, mm-hmm. which is a major development, and I wish you would comment on that and specifically on Syria and what you think should be done vis-a-vis Syria.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll start with Responsibility to Protect. So back in 1948, 3 years basically after World War II ended, the UN passed the Genocide Convention, which basically stated that if there were ever a situation where the United Nations identified a genocide that was going on, and there's all these, you know, genocide is a legal term, so leaders have gotten around the use of the word genocide by calling things ethnic cleansing or mass killings instead of actually using genocide. But the convention says that if a genocide is going on, that you have an obligation to respond. That sadly has not really held true. Actually, this is the first time, you know, as I mentioned, leaders have found ways to get around this. So in 1994, when the genocide was raging in Rwanda, and literally within 100 days, over 800,000 people were killed. There were memos going around the Clinton administration basically saying, in reviewing the literature, I think we should start using the word ethnic cleansing instead of genocide, because using the word genocide might require us to, in quotes, actually do something. Darfur is actually the first situation in which two U.S. presidents now, George Bush and now Barack Obama, have called something a genocide while it's occurring, so that's a good first step. But then the backlash is they still haven't done anything about it. As you saw at the end of the film, Omar al-Bashir is wanted. A warrant was put out for his arrest, first for crimes against humanity and then mass atrocity crimes, and then finally a year later for genocide. So the international community has now recognized what's happening in Darfur as a genocide, but haven't adhered to the Genocide Convention of 1948. So, you know, that's one thing to be said about what laws mean in our world. What the question was commenting on was a newer law called international law called Responsibility to Protect, which basically goes a step further, basically saying that that heads of state have a moral and legal responsibility to protect the rights, the human rights of their citizens. And when they do not do that, the international community has a lawful right to intervene for human rights abuses. So that's been called on in certain situations of recently, you know, Libya and now Syria. People are saying that the international community should get involved. In terms of my thoughts on Syria, you know, I try not to comment on these things in public forums like these because it's such they're such complicated situations, and it's, you know, it's very easy for me to sit here and say what should be done and what I think should be done. And these really come down to, I think, the use of whether or not we want to use military force, whether that's American military force or NATO force or just continued diplomatic options. And I don't know, I never like commenting on those things in public forums. I think these are really, you know, delicate decisions that may need to be made by people individually. So I don't know. I think commenting on Syria is a little bit above my pay grade at the moment.
It makes me feel it gets me very upset when I hear something like that we haven't learned yet that we do have to help people that go through these horrible genocides. I mean, when I see little children, women, they're the ones that usually suffer the most. It's something that lasts with you all your life. You never, never forget it. You have to live with it. It's very, very hard. They have to think not so much a country. They should think sometimes about the individuals. It gets me, it makes me very angry that not more is done. I wish they would do something more.
Thank you for being here. It's an astonishing movie. And
thank
you very much. I guess there is a legal framework in the United Nations that you talked about, and mm-hmm. I understand that you don't want to talk about specific countries and things like that, but do you have a sense that there could be multinational organizations that could sort of be on standby? I mean, this is not something that happens rarely, really, unfortunately.
Sure.
What kind of system would you like to see internationally that could intervene so that it's not necessarily always a particular country or, you know, a particular president who has to respond to it?
Sure, that's a very good question. So I guess the biggest takeaway, the biggest lesson that I learned from making this film is something that's very eloquently said by Jacqueline, which is, you know, conflicts like these, atrocities like these don't happen overnight. That, you know, you don't just wake up one day and you want to kill your neighbors, as she say. It's something that happens through a long process of brainwashing, of all different things that happen at very different levels, where rights are slowly stripped away, and then you get to the point where it's okay to start killing people. And if you know, it's very difficult, and it's you can't really compare genocides on certain levels to other, because they all have their own, you know, unique horrific traits. But there are certain lessons, common lessons you can pull from them, and those lessons are often warning signs. So, you know, as you heard Jacqueline say, in the years leading up to the genocide in Rwanda, Tutsis were called both, you know, person-to-person interactions, also on national radio, cockroaches. Similarly, Jews in Europe before the Holocaust started were called rats. You know, Jews were made to wear Jewish stars, Stars of David, on their clothes before the Holocaust, just as Tutsis were made to carry around national ID cards that said whether they were Tutsi or Hutu. Adam speaks about one of the first things he remembers before, you know, when things got really bad in Darfur, he remembers Darfuris were no longer allowed to own to go to school or own businesses, similar to what happened in the Holocaust. So there's really a range of warning signs that you can recognize. So I think the real need that the international community is starting to wake up to now is prevention, that there are ways to recognize these things long before they start, and so you can try to figure out solutions before you get to violence. So actually just last year, the U.S. Congress passed the first genocide prevention legislation, which was basically, you know, it was a bill that was basically testing the waters, saying if we propose genocide prevention legislation, would you vote for it? And it passed pretty strongly. And so sometime this year, there is hope of creating a genocide prevention policy for the U.S. And there's been a lot of NGOs that have done work basically, you know, graphing out warning signs and putting up countries. Basically, they created a list of the 33 countries that were at most at risk for mass atrocity crimes. So I think what I would like to see, both at a national level in terms of foreign policy and an international level, would be recognizing warning signs that can kind of predict an ugly future and starting to intervene very harshly and diplomatically, but harshly, before things get to the point that we're seeing in places like Syria and places like Darfur.
Again, thank you. That was very educational for me.
Thank you.
But I, being ignorant really about a lot of it, I remember when Bush started the war, more or less, or fighting, that they kept saying, why aren't you going to, and I think it was Rwanda then, where there's a genocide going on. And they'd say a little bit about it, but it didn't focus on it. And then you're also saying that the NATO's part of this. So why wasn't anybody doing anything at that time? Why were we headed one direction instead of the other?
Yeah. Sadly, it comes down to the fact that no president in the U.S., at least, and probably in the world, has ever been elected or voted out of office for not intervening or promising to intervene in a genocide. What happened, you know, politically, what happened in 1994 in the genocide in Rwanda was a few months before the killing started in Rwanda. President Clinton had sent American troops into Somalia because they were having issues there, and that resulted in the Black Hawk Down incident where several American troops lost their lives. And Clinton received huge political backlash from that incident. And so when a few months later, this idea of sending American troops back into Rwanda to stop other atrocities that the American public just didn't seem to think mattered to them, you know, he balked at it. He wasn't touching it. Similarly with Bush, you know, when he went into Iraq, there was public will for it. You know, rightly or wrongly, people felt like that's where American forces needed to go, whereas there's not much political will to say we need to go to Darfur and stop what's happening there. So that's sad and disappointing news. It's also good news because it means we can change that. You know, if we all believe and we all prioritize atrocities, humanitarian issues, wherever they're occurring in the world, and we speak our voices and tell our leaders that and hold our leaders accountable to that, it means that we can change that.
But what about the other countries? Why were they not more involved too?
Similar reasons, I would assume. You know, they're leaders in a lot of the most of the world leaders are democratically elected, and they're in countries that don't give many political rewards for intervening in human rights tragedies, unfortunately. Also, a lot of countries around the world sort of follow the United States' lead in issues like this, and certainly the UN's lead.
Again, thank you. This was a wonderful film. I was wondering if Beth, if you could address that same question that this that the previous woman brought up in speaking about Rwanda, but also address it from the historical perspective of the United States and the Holocaust, the reaction of the United States to the Holocaust and what that was. And, you know, because we're looking at a historical perspective of not responding, what that was at that time. And then if I could ask a second question. It was really interesting in the film to see how religion and belief was such a strong motivating force, and especially after something so horrendous. And I was wondering if Bea could speak to your experience with that, how belief or your religion did or did not play a role in your experience. So thank you.
Well, I think when we look at the historical references of what was happening during World War II and question, and I think specifically about what was happening in Auschwitz, the question of whether or not the camp should have been bombed. Bea and I have spoken about this, the question of what was really being told in the United States and what was being addressed. And at that time, there were different sides of the issue. There was pressure within the United States, within smaller groups on the president, and the answers partially from the president were, we have to be conscious of the civilians who are in that area, but at the same time, it would have stopped the entrance into Auschwitz. A few days ago, we had 4 survivors of the St. Louis ship, the boat that had left Europe in May of 1939, which was 6 months before Germany entered Poland when World War II began. The boat was sent or was on its way to Cuba and arrived at Cuba and was not allowed entrance and went to Florida and sat outside Miami's shores, and they were denied entrance. 900 European Jews were denied entrance into the United States and sent back to Europe. And of those 900, hundreds of them died in the camps later on. And so the questions were, what kind of pressure was going on with these administrations, and why wasn't more done? There were Jewish contingencies that were going to the government and protesting on the steps of the Capitol to no avail. This country did know what was going on in the camps. And when those soldiers who arrived in 1945 and liberated the camps, they were completely naive to what they were going to find. So it's a travesty in many, many respects. So the history is much more complicated than that, but just a few examples of what was going on. I don't know if you have anything to add.
No.
And B, your response to the feelings of faith and belief in God, and as a young girl, you were a very young girl, mm-hmm. How did that affect you?
Well, I was, in one way, it was fortunate. I grew up in an Orthodox Jewish home, and I knew a lot of my prayers. And it really helped me that my father taught me as much about the religion as he did. And especially after I lost my parents, God was not only my God, he was everything to me. My father, my mother, I used to talk to him. And that helped me tremendously, even though when I came to the convent and for the first time, I was less afraid and I didn't have to move all the time. And I didn't think the Nazis were after me anymore. I asked one of the sisters whether I could convert to Catholicism. But thank God, she looked at me and she says, I tell you what, if you still feel that way after the war, you can come back to us. But in the meantime, I want you to remember your father's teaching. And it was at that time when I did remember my father's teaching. And I was still fairly young, but it dawned on me, if I gave up my religion, I would also be giving up my heritage, my parents, my sister, my family, and I couldn't do that. But religion was very important to me.
Now we are talking about genocide. I can remember right now three genocides, Cambodia, Armenia, and Biafra. If we never talk about them, if they're not, we don't make movies, it's if it never happened. We must remember all these kinds of genocide also.
Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, in making the film, we, you know, just for, in terms of making a film that was only 85 minutes, we and wanting to really give the audience an opportunity to get to know the subjects who are there watching, the people, the survivors' stories they were hearing, we had to limit ourselves, obviously, and, you know, we chose the four survivors that we did. A lot of it just kind of happened organically, where we kind of stumbled upon them on our journey. But as you mentioned, you know, there's unfortunately countless atrocities that could be included in the story, some of which are some of which stories we hear more often than others, but they're all equally horrific and heartbreaking.
I just want to mention, while we're getting the microphone, my neighbors were Armenian, and may their memories be for a blessing, but Badir was their name, and Dr. Badir lived to be 98 years old and told his story about his family marching out of Armenia. And I'm so glad that I had that opportunity to hear his testimony and speak with them so often.
I just want to just add one more thing about the importance of remembering these things. Actually, when he was planning the final solution, as the Holocaust was called, Hitler was quoted as saying, you know, and people were asking him how he thought he could get away with something like this, and he was quoted as saying, "Who today remembers the Armenians?" So. Yeah, it's very important that we remember these horrific incidents of the past.
Well, I would just like to say this was a phenomenal movie. I think as an educator, we do a disservice to students not sharing things like this. And I'm looking at the Last Survivor Educational Resource Guide, and I just wondered if you could share a little bit about how we could implement that, and also on a more personal, practical level, like what organization, or I read that you can go to the website, and how we could actually help in a, I don't know, more practical way, whether it's giving, like, where would you recommend funding going to?
Sure. Okay, well, so few questions in that one. The first one is about the Last Survivor Education Initiative, which we actually just launched in January. So if you go to our website, thelastsurvivor.com, there's kind of links to follow to what's called the Last Survivor Classroom Action Project, and it's basically a DVD kit. It comes with a DVD and a full educational curriculum that was written by a education specialist that basically it follows the themes of the film, it follows the storylines of the film, and it pairs different education plans or education sessions, classroom sessions and activities around specific parts of the film. And it incorporates both the film itself as well as other historical examples. So it's a really great overall educational tool for learning about the history of genocide. And one other thing it really promotes, as the film does, is civic engagement, civic action to stop this. So that brings us to the second question, which are what are the organizations that I would recommend? Well, I mean, there's a ton of ways to get involved in these things, and it totally depends on the amount of time and the amount of effort you're willing to put into it. If we have these little cards, you can see it on the website, thelastsurvivor.com, but it's basically, you know, if you have 5 minutes, you can do this. If you have 10 minutes, that. If you have a week, whatever it is. If you have a little time each week. So there's an organization called United to End Genocide. It used to be called Save Darfur and the Genocide Intervention Network, and they kind of merged. And they have this wonderful, really easy tool called 1-800-GENOCIDE. It's basically a genocide prevention hotline where you can call and you can speak directly. They'll connect you directly to your senators, your congressmen, and the president of the United States. And you can either call and speak to someone, or more likely get a voicemail. And you can just basically leave a message speaking about whatever is on your mind, whether you want to speak to them about what's happening in Syria and what you'd like to be seen done there, or what's happening in Darfur or South Sudan and what you'd like to happen there. And they give you a host of talking points as well if you know you want something to be done but you're not sure how to articulate it. So that's a really easy tool. They also they have this organization, a student organization called STAND, which I don't think they have at the high school level, but they have it at every college, well, not every, but they have a lot of colleges around the U.S. as a STAND chapter. So those are student groups that are doing a lot of work to prevent genocide, mostly on a political level. The other thing that I think is an incredible use of time, you know, one of the most moving experience and life-changing experience I had in making the film was really getting to know Justin. I met Justin at the airport in St. Louis when he first arrived in the U.S., and I got to spend his first week here with him. And, you know, as you probably saw a little bit in the film, he had no idea what was happening here. It was, you know, everything from going with him to shop to just teaching him how to, like, use a payphone. And he did have people helping him. He was met by an organization called the International Institute in St. Louis. But basically what I learned is that there are refugee resettlement organizations in every city in the U.S., and I'm told you guys have a very big refugee population here in Omaha, and they can always use help and always use volunteers. And it's such a, you know, you always think about atrocities like this, and my mind at least focuses immediately on the deaths. But then you hear this other number of refugees, you know, in Darfur there are millions of refugees that it's really hard to imagine how traumatically your life is altered and what an experience that must be to, you know, not in Justin's case, not knowing where your family is, having survived 12 years as a refugee in Africa, not really sure how you were going to survive, finally coming to this unknown country where you're given basically 3 months where they support you, and then you have to find a job and you're on your own. It's a really vulnerable time, and I think if you are able to find an organization here in Omaha and volunteer with them and these refugees in their time of need, it's an incredible service for them and just an incredible experience for you as well. And then, of course, if you go to lastsurvivor.com, each of the survivors in the film has their own organization, which they can always use help with. So there's tons of options out there, which is a good thing.
And just before we take the next question, we actually have a couple of people here in the audience. We have some teachers who've done some things in class. Hopefully, maybe they'll be able to say a couple of things. And we have Dr. Ruthie Margalit, who works with some of the community who's settling here in Omaha. So afterward, if you're interested, we can hook you up with those resources that are right here in the room.
Okay. Sorry. A couple questions. I'm right here in the middle. Okay. In regards to the religion thing, I can't obviously understand what any of these people have gone through, but I think I can understand grasping onto the whole God thing. But did you experience anybody who said, no, there's no God, you haven't seen what I've seen, and I'm really angry, and God, to hell with God?
Yeah.
Did you meet anybody who had that perspective?
Yeah,
because
yeah.
You always hear about these people who are praising God and hallelujah and all that, but where are the people who are like, okay, what the, you know,
yeah,
where's God?
You know, they always say, kind of like, filmmakers, the hardest part about being a filmmaker is all the stuff that ends up on the cutting room floor, so the things that don't make it into the film. And there was one line that we tried so hard to get in, and it just never worked. But, you know, obviously religion and faith played a huge and continues to play a huge role in Justin's life. And we spoke to Hetty about it. We spoke to Hetty about the role religion played and faith. And, you know, Justin has this really fascinating line at the end of the film where he said, you know, he can accept everything that happened to him because he thinks it happened for a purpose, which was very strange in some ways to hear. And we asked Hetty that, you know, that question is, you know, basically what you're asking me, what role did faith play for you, and can you find purpose in any of this? And she said, you know what, I would like to believe that everything in the world happens for a reason. I would like to believe that there's purpose in this world, but I could never say that because of the Holocaust. There is no way I can find any sort of purpose or meaning in the Holocaust. So, yeah, I mean, I think Justin is really one end of the spectrum, but there's many, many people who feel differently, including Hetty.
I have one more question.
Sure.
I'm really skeptical of we sit and we talk about, you can talk to your senator, you can do that. Sure. I mean, I love all these things that we're trying to do. But, I mean, let's face it, 6 million people, you know, 6 million Jews. I don't know how many people here. We can go on. And it's like, we can talk about this all we want.
Right.
My question is, do you think it's more effective, like this Kony 2012 movement, where it's one guy going out on YouTube and getting maybe a group of people like us to really... I mean, I think they're pressuring the government, but do you think that maybe individuals, you know, we kind of have to leave the government behind at some point and take it into our hands as citizens individually? Do you think that's more effective from what you've seen, or as effective, or?
Sure. Well, I mean, it's a really hard question. Is, you know, we haven't found a way to end this yet, so it's hard to say what's effective. The Kony 2012 video was effective in that it raised awareness for this incredible, you know, this horrific tragedy, in that over 100 million people saw it. We don't know that it's effective yet, in that, you know, Joseph Kony's not been brought to justice. And then, you know, there's all sorts of other issues with it. But in terms of individuals, yes, I completely agree and believe in the power of individuals over, you know, government, and that government is supposed to reflect the will of individuals. So it's up to us to sort of speak our minds and pressure government. I also think, because I'm like so firmly convinced in this idea that genocide is a sort of really far end of a spectrum, right? It's something that ends in genocide, but on the other hand, it's just discrimination and intolerance, and whether it be bullying or whatever it might be. So I do believe that if we try to fight it on this end of the spectrum, and, you know, I've heard a lot of you are teachers here, and, you know, we're working with younger people, and if we can just instill in young people the idea of tolerance and mutual respect and love of other cultures that are different from our own, that's, I think, the surest way we can fight as individuals. You know, I asked Sasha basically once, who's been an incredibly inspiring figure in my life, what he felt young people could do to sort of end these atrocities. And he said, very simply, get to know your neighbors. You know, your neighbors come from such different backgrounds and places and have such different perspectives and incredible stories, that if you just sort of make an effort to get to know people who on the surface seem very different, I think we're going a long way in the long run fighting these things at a very individual level. And especially now with technology that allows us to meet people from different cultures, you know, wherever they may be in the world, you know, it's a lot harder for people to convince you that someone else doesn't matter when you know that someone else personally.
B, would you like to respond to that as well?
Okay. What you said was exactly right. Because once you get to know someone, it just is different. I mean, the differences almost disappear because you find out you have more in common than you realize. I speak at schools, and I usually tell the kids that the most important thing they can do is to educate themselves. Because when you think about it, without education, you can't really have a democracy. And that is the problem with a lot of countries, when they don't have a democracy. Also, I think it is very important to teach children not to have prejudice against anyone. And that's really up to the parents. You have to start that when they're very young. And also, to me, what's very frightening nowadays is this bullying. That is also something that... if it's not checked, it can really go into something very big, I feel. And it has to be checked. Also, as soon as somebody notices somebody's a bully, they have to put a stop to it. To me, I think Hitler started out being a bully. And I, as you were talking, Michael, I was thinking, too, in Germany, really, Hitler gave a lot of signs of this. When you think about it, often when I tell my story and I talk about Kristallnacht, and I think about it, and I say to the kids, if after Kristallnacht, if the German people would have stood up and said to Hitler, "Enough is enough," or if some country would have said, "Enough is enough," we might not have had World War II. But nothing happened, and therefore Hitler got the green light. He could do whatever he wanted with the Jews and with other people too. So I feel that is very important.
I just wanted to add that I work at Lutheran Family Services, and we resettle in the Omaha and Lincoln metropolitan area refugees from Darfur, Bhutan, Burma, Somalia, and other countries, Burundi. And we would love to have volunteers if they would like to volunteer for us. Our website is www.lfsneb, which stands for Lutheran Family Services of Nebraska.org. And then you can register to volunteer and just specify on your application for volunteer that you're going to work with refugees, and we'll help you out. Thank you.
Thank you for pointing that out.
First, I want to thank you for a very powerful movie. I have a personal connection here. My mother is a survivor of the Warsaw Ghetto in her 85th year as well. And I think you really did a good job depicting the issue. And so thank you for bringing it to the large audience. I'm so glad Lutheran Family Services are here. The other organization in town, and there are over 20,000 refugees in Nebraska. So I think the audience should know the magnitude of the our hosting as a state. The other organization is the Southern Sudan Community Association, which also doesn't focus only on Sudanese. So these two very, very important resettlement organizations do a huge amount of work, and please just Google them, check them out. Through the medical center, we're also working with the refugees through Bridge to Care. So if you're interested, contact us as well. One thing that came out in the movie, which I think is really important but wasn't a big focus, is to create some avenues for the stories to come out. So people who are here and are experiencing how to use, you know, first time the toilet and the cupboards and what goes in the fridge or the cupboards or where, I mean, from very elemental and things, have tremendous stories. There are about 68% have suffered torture. And we don't talk about it. We want them to assimilate right away. I wonder if you have found, if you have heard from the people you interviewed, if there are any ways that is more helpful to get these stories out, for them to share. From our interaction with the refugees, it seems like it's a huge deal. And people are very empowered when they're asked to write or to talk or to present and in some way or form their heritage.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Thank you for all that information. It's wonderful. I mean, I'd be curious to hear from you, B, when you felt comfortable for the first time sharing your story, because I know from a lot of the survivors I spoke with, it's just a lot of them, it takes a lot of time. You know, it's obviously a very, very traumatic part of their lives that some people are just ready to talk about sooner than others, and some never are. I think those who have spoken about it do express this feeling of empowerment, but some are just don't want to talk about it. But I'd be curious to hear from you how long it took you before you were really ready to speak about
It took me a long time because when I came to New York City, nobody wanted to talk about it. Even my family didn't want to talk about it. So I kept quiet. I did get married, and my husband, he was very interested, and I told him the story. And then we lived at that time in a small town, O'Neill, Nebraska. We were the only Jewish family. And I happened to attend the Dale Carnegie course. And in that course, you had to stand in front of an audience and talk about some of your childhood experiences. So I told them a little bit about me, and there was the husband of a teacher who listened to me. And one day he came home and told his wife about me. Soon I get a phone call from her, and she wanted to hear my story. And for the first time, I told to somebody besides my husband my story. It was very hard. I cried through the whole thing. And she said to me, you know, it would be wonderful if you could come and attend a teacher's tea and tell your story. At first, I didn't want to do it, but my husband encouraged me. He says, do it. They need to know. Do it. So I did do it, and I spoke to them for about an hour, and before I knew it, they started calling me to speak at the various schools. Also, at that time was the Eichmann trial, and that made it, they were very curious, and so in one way, I started not only going to schools, I went to churches, service clubs, and I did an awful lot of speaking. But for me, it was good because it was healing to me because I always received a very good feedback, especially from children. And to this day, I like to do it because I feel I'm doing something constructive. And like I say, the response I get is fantastic, and I'm very thankful that I am able to do it.
Today I received an email with an article from O'Neill, Nebraska, about a special Holocaust presentation that they were doing in the community, so I think that that had something to do with you long down the road.
That's special.
I think we have. Do we have time for one more, or are we?
Do we? One more.
One more final question.
I don't have a question. Just a comment. I teach at the college level, and I teach about social inequality and racial and ethnic discrimination. And I just want to tell you, B, especially, but you know, also with the film, thank you for giving a piece of yourself and telling your story. Because it puts a human face on it that I can tell my students that I met you. I spent time with the survivors from the SS St. Louis as well. And it just makes me think of a comment that one of my students said recently when we were discussing these things in class. She said, thank you so much for telling me about this. You know, I just didn't realize that it wasn't that long ago that there was discrimination. You know, especially students that are privileged enough to go to college and live in a safe place. They're lucky enough that they haven't been exposed to it, but to expose them to it in a way that they can receive it in a way that informs them to be more open and kind and loving people and aware and active. It just means a lot that you're willing to do this. It brings a humanity to inhumanity, you know? So thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Michael and Bea and Beth, and thank you all for coming tonight.
Thanks for having us.
We've heard a panel discussion which followed a screening of the 2010 documentary film The Last Survivor, directed by Michael Clayman and Michael Pertnoy. This program, presented in collaboration with the Institute for Holocaust Education, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, May 3, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The members of the panel have included Michael Clayman, the director of the film, B. Karp, a survivor of the Nazi Holocaust, and Beth Selden-Doton, the director of the Institute for Holocaust Education at Omaha's Jewish Community Center. Special thanks to Rachel Jacobson, Casey Logan, Maggie Wood, and Jim Foyt of FilmStreams for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 200 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.